but to take God at his word.
All these triumphant, I am the warrior God who has conquered all things, yeah. And they all belong to me, not in the future, but now.
Right. I'm getting all excited here, man.
There you All right, welcome back to Eschatology Matters. I'm Josh Howard, and today I'm joined by Dr. Daniel Hummel from UW-Madison. So, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to Eschatology Matters.
Pleasure to be here.
So, Daniel, you've got a book coming out, and I want to get right down to it without a whole lot of chit-chat or introductory matter, because I'm really interested in this, and the title of the book alone, I'll let you say whether you came up with this or this is a joint effort, but the title is just so interesting to me. Title of the book coming out in May is The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism, and then subtitle, How the Evangelical Battle Over the End Times Shaped a Nation, which that title... I just wonderful, because so interesting to me. But tell me a little bit about how did this topic come up, and what was it about this topic that engaged you? How did this come about? How did this project start for you? And where are you writing from there in Madison?
Yeah, well, good to be with you, Josh. To answer the last one first, I am working at a Christian study center at the UW-Madison. It's called Upper House. You can go on our website and see sort of our what we're all about. We're also part of a larger consortium of Christian study centers. There's about 40 of us, and we're all across the country at different, usually large public or, you know, Ivy League type universities, just trying to be salt and light on those campuses. So that's where I'm writing from right now. And most of the book I wrote when I was working here. I can't take full credit for the title. I had parts of the title, the rise and fall part. I knew that from the beginning. Okay. The subtitle was me working with Erdmans, my publisher. There's a lot of the sort of how the blank made something happen in large scale in the U.S. is a very popular subtitle right now. So we sort of worked with that template. As we talk, I quibble a little with parts of the subtitle because I'm a pretty precise person. And so I don't want to overstate anything in the book. But yeah, the book is a history of dispensationalism, which I think most of your viewers, listeners will get a general sense of what that is. But I'm a historian by training. I got my PhD in religious and intellectual history. And so I'm coming at dispensationalism less from a theological or theologian's perspective, less trying to evaluate whether it's true or not, though I can talk about that if you want, and more trying to understand how it emerged as an ism, as a system of beliefs and teachings that ended up shaping a huge swath of American Christianity for a very long time, for almost a century, I'd say. Mm. And then also how that system of beliefs has fallen on hard times. When I talk about the fall of dispensationalism, I don't mean it's disappeared at all. There's many dispensationalists still active, and many sort of popular versions that are very active as well. But I do see a decline in its academic credibility within the evangelical fundamentalist world, and a sort of story of major questions and critiques landing, particularly in the second half of the 20th century. That allow me to talk about a fall of dispensationalism from a more sort of scholarly approach to one that's really dominated now by popular culture and things like the Left Behind series.
Okay. No, that's super helpful. And I'm glad you phrased it that way and so carefully, right? So like, cause rise and fall, that was one of the things that just first caught my attention. And I think it's going to catch a lot of people's attention is, what does he mean by rise? But more importantly, probably, what does he mean by fall? Is he saying this thing's gone away? So we can get into that a little bit. Now I see that you've previously written kind of in this general realm. I think you had a book called Covenant Brothers. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
That was on evangelical Jewish relations or something of that nature.
Yeah, that was a history of Christian Zionism, sort of a similar topic that intersects with dispensationalism, but is different also. Right. And that was actually my dissertation here at UW-Madison. And that was a very archival heavy study. I went to Israel. I learned Hebrew enough to be able to read Israeli documents in their sort of government archives to try to understand the origins of how American Anglo-American evangelicals got really interested in supporting Israel and then actually linking up with the government there to create what we call today the Christian Zionist movement. So dispensationalism is in the mix there, though it's a much bigger phenomenon than just dispensationalists doing For that sure. type of Christian Zionist activism. So this is a project that actually came out of some of the thinking I was doing during my dissertation on that project. But this one is a little broader and definitely a bigger sweep of time, starting all the way back with, you know, John Nelson Darby in the 1830s and then going all the way up to the present.
Right. So now you mentioned the first study coming from kind of from your doctoral research, and this is, you know, something that kind of came from that. Is this current work, The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism, what's the general audience for this? Is this more of like a academic historical work? Is this, you know, lay level? Like, what could the reader expect from this sort of study?
Yeah, I definitely wrote it with a broader audience in mind than just scholars of dispensationalism or eschatology or anything like that. There's really sort of simple ways that I did that, which are shorter chapters, pictures, other things to make it just a more interesting book. But I was also really trying to think about terminology, about making sure, I mean, as you know, when you talk about eschatology, even that word is often something you have to unpack for lay readers. But there's so many other long words, you know, dispensational premillennialism is a 7-syllable, just mouthful. So I did try to write, I don't have any illusions that this is going to be, something you could just pick up without any background knowledge on any of this stuff. I don't even think the title would really lend itself to someone who had no idea what dispensationalism was, but it is intended to have a broader readership. I really tried to elevate some of the characters, people from Darby up to people like Schofield in the early 20th century, and then maybe some people that are less well known outside of more academic circles, people like Lewis Sperry Chafer, who founded Dallas Seminary, and others. And then I also really tried to connect the academic scholarly story, which is very interesting and is actually the part that probably is the least covered by other scholars that I write about, and connect that to the more popular culture manifestations of dispensationalism. Everything from, you know, bestsellers in the late 19th century, like Jesus Is Coming, which was one of the first popularizations by a guy named William Blackstone, to Hal Lindsey's Like Great Planet Earth in the 1970s, to, you know, the sort of schlock apocalyptic movies in the 1970s, to the Left Behind novels and stuff like that.
Okay. And that kind of gets to one of the things that I was going to ask you, and I'm glad you went that way with it, because so you're talking about a rather large swath of what you're including within dispensationalism. I was going to ask you as a follow-up, and I still will, is just what your definition, kind of your working parameters for dispensationalism is, because I know typically within any circle, some people will, you know, they will ascribe that label to themselves, and then yet they will hear others ascribing that label to themselves, and they say, whoa, I'm not with that guy, that's not part of our group, and that sort of thing. So, like, what were your kind of parameters for including dispensational thought? Because, you know, as you mentioned, you have, especially in decades past, you had a lot of guys that were doing a lot of writing, a lot of articles even that were coming out from dispensational circles. But then you also had a lot of bargain bin, you know, Christian basement type material. So speak a little bit about that for us.
Yeah, and this is I'm going to be annoying and be a historian in part of this, which is to say that part of this changes over time. And I know that can be very frustrating to people who really see these, you know, terms like dispensationalism or covenantalist or other related terms as sort of trans-historical, sort of fixed in a universal categories. But as a historian, I mean, one important thing to note is the term dispensationalism doesn't actually come about until 1927. So it's a very late term, like if you did the Oxford Dictionary etymology of the term. And it actually comes about by a critic who is trying to identify a modern heresy. That critic is Philip Morrow, a Reformed theologian of the early 20th century. And so he is the originator of the term. And so that, to me already, as a historian, I think, all right, so this term is sort of thrust upon a group of people, and they do end up taking ownership of it, famously, or probably not famously, outside of certain circles. Lewis Sperry Chafer, the founder of Dallas Seminary, writes a very long essay in 1936 in his own journal, Bibliotheca Sacra. And he says, fine, I'm going to be called a dispensationalist. And so that's 1936. So when we talk about John Nelson Darby or Schofield, who dies in 1921, these people would never have responded to the term dispensationalism. Mm. And so that is part of my definition, is trying to understand what is at stake when people call themselves dispensationalists or not. Now, beyond that, there are sort of tried and true doctrines that I see as sort of inherently dispensationalist. The most important goes all the way back to Darby. And it is a what I've called a sort of dualism at the heart of how he reads the Bible and understands the world. And that dualism is between heaven and earth, And then the, sort of the two peoples of God that represent those two, which would be for the earth, the Jewish people or Israel, and for heaven, the church. And that is, it can get confusing because Darby is not a literalist in way later dispensationalists are. So he does not derive that reading from a, quote, literal hermeneutic of the Bible. He has, so that's like an a priori view he's bringing to the text. But later dispensationalists pick it up and read a literalist hermeneutic around it. I would say for dispensationalists after the 1920s, that literalist hermeneutic is very, very important to what it means to be a dispensationalist. And certainly that's one of the areas of terrain that a lot of discussion is over. There's also a few other doctrines that are dispensational, or at least are sort of consequences of a dispensational theology, but may not be about the end times in particular. So one of them is around what we could call soteriology, around what does it mean to be saved? And this comes out later in the 20th century around sort of the lordship salvation controversy. And dispensationalists tend to have a very sort of low view of the barrier to be saved. It's often called the free grace tradition. And this isn't explicitly taught by Darby or Schofield, but it actually Schofield gets there pretty closely. But it's a consequence of the way they see the contrast between law and grace, and how they sort of see that salvation needs to be a purely sort of a grace oriented act. And so even a mental assent, that's another thing that view is called, is a mental assent salvation. Even a mental assent to the Lord or to Jesus as your savior can save you. This becomes very controversial in the 80s around John MacArthur, who sort of is bridging some of these camps. But it's a distinctly dispensationalist view on salvation, at least in the American church. And then one other area that is important for dispensationalism is ecclesiology, or what it means to be, who is the church, and what are its boundaries, and what is its mission. And this is where Darby would be different from later dispensationalists. So Darby was the founder of the Plymouth Brethren, a group that basically said you need to dissociate from every existing denomination, and there should not be a professional clergy class. That's a distinctive of the Brethren. And he was very frustrated as he was spreading his teachings in the U.S. in the 1870s and 80s. He was frustrated that the Americans who picked up his eschatology did not pick up his ecclesiology. And so the most famous popularizer of Darby was a Presbyterian minister named James Brooks in St. Louis. Brooks was a lifelong Presbyterian and never even contemplated leaving. And this was a huge problem for someone like Darby. And if you look on later dispensationalists, people who actually call themselves dispensationalists and constructed the theology, their ecclesiology is a lot different than Darby's. They tend to be, you know, more fundamentalist, and there are definite like separation, you know, measures of separation. But there's plenty of dispensationalists who are Southern Baptist, who are certain strands of Presbyterian and others, at least historically. The Reformed Episcopal Church had a lot of dispensationalists in it. So that's another distinctive. And so with each of these, as you can tell, I'm not coming down on like a precise definition, because it is of debate in the historical record of what actually a true dispensationalist view on some of these things is. I would say, you know, some of the end time stuff everyone agrees on, but on a lot of the border stuff, that's actually the fun of the story, is understanding how do certain things become dispensationalist and others not.
No, that's fascinating. No, that's really helpful. So let me ask another clarifying question. And essentially what I wanted to ask is, and I'll define what I mean, but who were your conversation partners then when you were working through this material? And what I mean by that, just so our viewers understand, is so you're talking about, again, you're looking at this historically, right? So yours is not primarily, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but a theological argument on is this true biblically, but more so, you know, what does this look like in the historical record? How does this rise and fall, to take off the title there? But then how do you choose conversation partners? And then what conversation partners did you find in this material? In other words, like, are you looking at primary sources from these figures you've just mentioned? Are you looking to lay level material, or popular level rather material? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as a historian, my main conversation partners are other historians. So there's been a lot written on the history of dispensationalism. And some of the main, you know, people that your audience might know are people like George Marsden or Mark Knoll. These are very sort of prominent historians in the field of American religious history. And there's a lot of other historians in there too. And there's a certain interpretation of what dispensationalism is, how it came about, and then sort of how influential it's been that exists in that literature. And I agree with some of it, disagree with other of it. And so if you look at my footnotes, and I have a really long bibliography at the end, a sort of essay, I wanted to sort of narrate what I was reading. You'll see that most of it's historians in that vein. And so I interact with historians who are dispensationalists. So there is a small body of literature written by dispensationalists about their own history. And then many historians who aren't, but who are trying to understand it on its terms. I do have my own views. So I grew up in this world, in a dispensational household. Many of my family, including my parents, I don't ask them this regularly, but I think they still define themselves as dispensationalists. My dad went to Dallas Seminary. Okay. I was a missionary kid. So I know the world, and I really respect a lot of people in that world. And so this isn't trying to sort of be a hit piece or anything. And I don't actually ascribe to it myself anymore. I would probably land as a historic premillennialist at this point. And even that distinction, your audience knows this, that's actually a really important distinction to most people at a place like UW or even in other parts of the church. It's all sounds like it's very similar together. Right. And so understanding those divisions is actually part of what I was hoping to do in the book, is really show like what's at stake when people define themselves in a certain eschatological category or not. I do end with a short, my epilogue talks about a few people that I don't know if I'd go all the way with them, but I talk about N.T. Wright and Richard Middleton, who's another theologian, sort of doing more what they call biblical eschatology. But something where if we're talking about sort of one of the major defining features of dispensationalism is its understanding that the kingdom is entirely in the future.
Right.
And that so many things flow from that reality. I land on something where it's an already not yet. The kingdom is here. We're working, kingdom work. And I find those, particularly Wright and Middleton, as helpful sort of theologians or I guess Wright's a historian, who are sort of saying things I would say to in that space.
Okay, I got you. No, that's super helpful. And if I'm hearing you correctly, then, because I know you said you'd framed this from a historian's perspective, right? Like you're not writing a theological piece. And I really appreciate you saying it's not a theological hit piece, because most of us, if we are not dispensational, have friends or family who are, who we wouldn't necessarily want to place outside Christian orthodoxy, right? So that's really helpful to note. But if I'm hearing you correctly, then this is something that even somebody without theological lenses on, like maybe even somebody without, from without Christianity, from outside of Christianity rather, would still find valuable. Is that a fair interpretation then?
That's the hope. I did go with Erdmann's. So Erdmann's is a Christian press, and people probably know when they pick up an Erdmann's book that it's going to be written by a Christian. I would think. But I wrote it sort of in dialogue with those other historians, many of whom are Christians, but are writing for a broader audience. Okay. And that's sort of where that subtitle comes from too, is wanting to sort of show how this theology that for many people might seem entirely sort of exotic or unfamiliar has had really important effects on American society. And that's a story that Christians need to hear, but that many other people need to hear as well.
So what you were just saying right there. So I pulled this from the book description on Amazon, so forgive me. But it says that dispensationalism is described as, quote, and again, these may not be your words, but what I pulled off Amazon, that it evaluates evangelicalism's most resilient and contentious popular theology, unquote. And I was just, again, the easy answer is going to be for you to tell me to grab the book when it comes out and to explore what that means and stuff. But could you give just like a little insight into that? Because I think for a lot of Christians coming into hearing something about dispensationalism, and I suspect for a lot of people that will grab this book and want to read this historical account, they're already familiar with dispensationalism, because for many evangelicals, especially, that's kind of the water in which you swim, right? You're the fish in the water. It's all around. And for many evangelicals, it was discovering it even had a name before even grappling with the theology behind it. So could you walk into that just a little bit? How did this thing come to be? Again, I know that's probably a significant portion of your book, but just how this thing came to be the water in which evangelicals swim.
Yeah, and that is a big, big story. It grows in popularity largely in the 1870s and 80s, and there's a lot of reasons for that I won't get into now. But the sort of particularly the eschatology, the idea that There's an imminent rapture that will soon happen. By soon, it's any moment it could happen. That there is then a 7-year tribulation that has a certain sort of unfolding, and then there is the second coming that will lead into the millennial kingdom. That type of teaching really grabs hold in about 150 years ago, 120 years ago. People like Dwight Moody, who was sort of the Billy Graham of his era, adopted this, though he probably didn't. He was sort of a he was a not a theologian, we should say. Right. So he wouldn't have defined it in exactly the same way, but he taught the rapture in his sermons and other things. And really, that's up to the 1910s, 1920s. Moody dies in 1899. There's a whole network around Moody that really sees they wouldn't call themselves dispensationalists. They see this as part of what evangelical theology is at the time, what conservative Bible-believing evangelical theology is. And that becomes even more so in the 1920s when we have the fundamentalist modernist split. And so you have all of the sort of conservatives or fundamentalists breaking off from their denominations. And many of those are dispensationalists, but many of them are not. And so people, when you get all the conservatives together and they start sort of hashing out, what does it mean to be a fundamentalist? This becomes a huge point of debate. And you can even see people like J. Gresham Machen, the famous Presbyterian fundamentalist. He is concerned about what he calls chiliism or premillennialism. He wasn't defining it as precisely as we would now. And he said, you know, we will work with those people, even if we have sort of fundamental disagreements with their eschatology, they're sound on these other things, so we're good with them. And that works for a little while, but by the 1930s, 1940s, there is this deep rift that's emerging in the fundamentalist world between dispensationalists and covenantalists. And this is something I think a lot of people take those terms for granted now, and they've been around for a few generations, but that division would have made no sense to the original fundamentalists. They did not divide themselves along those particular lines. And those lines come out in the 1930s, 1940s. Each side builds their own seminaries, their own journals, their own publishing houses that in part are intended to create the dispensationalist sort of camp and the reformed or covenantalist camp within the broader evangelical world. And these camps, I mean, they have bigger fish to fry than each other, but as you know, the saying that sometimes the bloodiest wars are civil wars, there's also a lot of animosity and a lot of sort of question of where's the fate of evangelicalism going to go. And so I read a lot of then some possibly familiar history of the later 20th century through that, the rise of the neo-evangelicals who have a particular non-dispensationalist eschatology. If you look at Carl Henry's famous book, The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism, there's a lot of eschatology in that book that people sort of gloss over. And then you can read the rise of the Christian right and the rise of dominion theology and other things through this lens of sort of debating about what dispensationalism is. At the same time, during this whole period, dispensationalism is very healthy, has its own seminaries. Many churches are run by pastors who are dispensationalists. And so there's a whole subculture, I grew up in it, that assumed this was just the way that, you know, the proper reading of the Bible happened. It was quite, interesting to learn as I was growing up that there were other people who were also called themselves Bible-believing Christians who did not think the same things about a lot of this stuff. And that's, that can be, you know, you can respond to that in different ways. I responded to it by trying to understand, you know, why other people would also say that without sort of taking a definitive side at that point. Right. I think, you know, as you get into the 80s, 90s, 2000s, I think it's harder and harder if you think about sort of just some of the pop theological movements, the growth of the sort of neo-reformed movement, the growth of the emergent church, or that sort of came and went, I guess. These things are very important to evangelical Christianity, but aren't dispensationalists in any way. So there's a lot of Christians out there who would be conservative in sort of, if you're just going to lump people into big categories like that, are going to be conservative on a lot of theology, but would differ from dispensationalism. And that to me is some of the most interesting stuff to explore is how does that happen? And ultimately sort of what are the consequences of that for how we understand the church today?
So I wonder, and that was, again, very helpful. I wonder, just hearing your walkthrough and you know, kind of scanning over the decades and even centuries here and looking at that, I wonder how much pushback you've heard from dispensational circles or maybe even that you got to interact with in the book and in the research that would debate especially like a start that locates it within John Nelson Darby. And, yeah. And the reason I'm asking is because I would come more from a theological camp than a historian. You know, I'm not a trained historian, right? So I have heard defenses of, you know, maybe even tracing roots of dispensationalism to the Reformation, or maybe even trying to trace them back to the apostolic times in some form, yeah, or fashion. But I would say typically what I've encountered, and this is just subjective, but I think typically what I've encountered have come from within theological circles, and from people I respect but disagree with. Have you encountered a lot of that pushback, specifically within your approach as a historian to the material?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely get the pushback, get the sort of quizzical looks and questions about that. And part of that is me sort of coming critically to some of dispensationalism's own histories of itself, mm-hmm, and seeing them sort of as not not convincing about sort of creating these sort of histories of who is a dispensationalist. Some of them, you know, quote a very specious quote by Augustine to sort of enlist him as a dispensationalist. He was sort of a premillennialist in his early career. He was not after that. But yes, I run into that a lot. I mean, part of this is trying to understand a particular social or intellectual movement and seeing how so much of it flows through the brethren and the influence. And it's not so. One thing I would say to sort of throw a bone to the dispensationalism, I don't try to explain everything through John Nelson Darby. He is definitely an important person because he led a movement, but there are many people around Darby that become sort of household names in American circles that are probably as important as Darby. Two of them would be William Kelly, who was Darby's editor and a very strong theologian in his own right. He's another brethren. And then a guy named C.H. McIntosh, who was more of a popular writer. Darby is not a fun person to read. I don't know if anyone in your audience has read Darby. He is very difficult. He never redrafted anything. So you get the first version of everything. He also has, you know, 19 million words in print, which is just unbelievable to think about how many words that is. And so he was very prodigious, but he was not clear. And he admitted this often. And he said, I rely on people around me to sort of simplify what I'm writing. But McIntosh was more of a devotional writer. He wrote commentaries, but also sort of popular stuff. He was probably much more important to spreading some of the core ideas of what became dispensationalism than was Darby. But I think it's very hard to sort of tell a story of sort of intellectual influence or institutional continuity much earlier than the 1830s. I don't know you can look to other premillennialist movements, but they're not going to be teaching anything close to what becomes dispensationalism, at least how I read it. So I also don't, I mean, this is where I try to be humble on my own commitments. I also don't think, many Protestants, I mean, this is a Protestant issue in a lot of ways. Like all of us have to sort of find a sort of provenance for what we believe is sort of the orthodox historic Christian faith. Right. And I don't know if anyone has a corner on that. I think there's debates that you can have about a lot of different views and scripture, sort of theological views, and exactly when did they come about. I think I would go with to sort of not judge anyone. I'd go with actually what something dispensationalists often have said, which is just because something comes about later does not make it false necessarily. And I did not try to go in. That's been one version of sort of hit pieces on dispensationalism, is to try to say, oh, this is so recent, how could it be true? How could something that is less than 200 years old be sort of the true way? I'm agnostic on that point. I do think there are issues, and I bring them up through the sources. Pretty strong critiques of some of the theology of dispensationalism, and sort of does that actually reflect the biblical text, or does it really hold together? But ultimately, on the historical question, I do ultimately root it in the 1830s, 1820s, but I don't see that as necessarily a disqualifier for its validity either.
No, that's super helpful. Yeah, no, that's super helpful. And I think that is a pushback that most of us have heard with dispensationalism is the primary critique oftentimes being leveled at its kind of historical newness. Let me ask you one question, because I do want to be respectful of your time. But one question, and you addressed it at the beginning, so I think it'd be good to address this toward the end as well, is when you speak about the rise and the fall, and I know you kind of nuanced that phrase fall, but what is your take, just kind of in a nutshell, on the current state and trajectory of dispensationalism, specifically within the United States where we are?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where I think fall is a good metaphor for me. So I would say there was sort of a high point of dispensationalism and its influence in, we can call it just American evangelicalism, right around 1960 to 1970, like that decade was pretty good. You had a very preeminent crop of scholars, John Walvoord, Charles Ryrie, Dwight Pentecost, others at Dallas, others, Alva McLean at Grace Seminary. Writing very important big books, and really training a ton of pastors and others to carry on the tradition. I think since then, it's been a pretty steady story of academic decline. There's very few seminaries that teach classic dispensationalism in their curriculum. There are some. They tend to be less well resourced and not, you know, what's considered like the mainstream of evangelical seminaries. Even Dallas Seminary, I mean, they do have some classic dispensationalists. They're also the sort of origin point of progressive dispensationalism, which is a later development in the 80s and 90s that is still dispensationalist in some ways. In other ways, it is quite different from what came before. And you see this because those people I mentioned, like Ryrie and Walvoord, were very concerned when progressive dispensationalism emerged. And they actually said, you shouldn't call this dispensationalism. It's too different. And it's different on certain technical things. It's also different on sort of blurring the dualism that I said was sort of at the heart of a lot of this. Right. And so, you know, part of the fall is that I don't know, I mean, they're out there, but I don't know many sort of distinguished scholars under the age of 50 who are dispensationalist. And that's a very worrying sign. If you're just looking at like a social movement, you really need to be producing, you know, young scholars who are looking to advance that school of thought. Hmm. There just aren't that many. If you just, you know, surveyed all of the Southern Baptist seminaries and all of the sort of non-denominational evangelical seminaries, you find very few diehard dispensationalists. Where you would find them is in the popular culture arena, which I know for many sort of Bible-believing dispensationalists are people who shouldn't even be associated with them, but they are sort of in some ways representing the name in more ways than any scholars would be. And there's still a very vibrant dispensationalist sort of pop culture industry. There are books that come out every year, every month, probably. There are movies. I think there's another Left Behind, by the way, coming out soon to a theater near you, probably. And I mean, that'll be like the, you know, the third movie version of, right, of that IP. And so there is some popularity there, and there are definitely sort of lay level devotionals and commentaries and other things. Many of them are for older people, frankly, and many of them are written by people who aren't credentialed in the way that you'd hope. A lot of theology is written by people who are, you know, really deep into the literature and other things. So the fall there, I look at the fall in part just in that way. And another way is that I think for a lot of the fathers of dispensationalism, going all the way back to Darby and Schofield and others, I think they'd be quite disappointed with the fate of dispensationalism as this sort of popular theology. And one that is really reduced in a lot of ways to its end time scenario and is not sort of a full-blown system of theology, which is at its best, dispensationalism had something to say about almost every part of theology. And I tell the story in the sort of the last third of the book, over the last 50 years or so, it's really been thinned out by its popularizers, and its sort of scholarly apparatus has really declined as well.
Okay. No, that's super helpful. Well, thank you again for jumping on here. Again, the book's title, and I'm going to read it to make sure I get it correct, The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism, How the Evangelical Battle Over the End Times Shaped a Nation, May of 23, if I'm reading it correctly.
Star Wars Day, May 4th.
Star Wars Day. Man, I hope you selected that date on purpose.
I did not, but I'm thinking about the Death Star and apocalypse and seeing if something can come from that. So
that's fantastic. Dr. Daniel Hummel, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time, sir.
It's been a pleasure.
All right.